Okay, we're going to get to the meat of the stuff. We're on page one, Bill's story, chapter one. All right, and this is my sponsor. When I got in on that Tuesday, you know, he told me to go home and read this again that night. And he said, don't look for the differences between you and Bill. See where you relate to Bill. All right, and so we'll talk about that as we go along, because this is some good stuff. And it says, war fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. There was love, applause, war. Moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. That's exactly how it was for me when I had arrived, you know. And it says, I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. Right? So there was a little bit of alcoholism in Bill's history, and they kind of warned him up, and he was just like me, and I'm like, why would I stop drinking? It works so great. All right. And it says, in time we sailed for over there. I was very lonely again and again turned to alcohol. So here he is in all this excitement and alcohol seems to work, and he gets very, very lonely and alcohol seems to work. Alcohol's doing a job for Bill. It's working. Right? And it says, we landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Ominous forewarning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. Bill likes himself, don't he? He's got that ego going, right? He feels very, very highly about himself. And he says, I took a night law course and attained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd prove to the world that I was important. We got any provers out here? You're going to show them? You're going to show them that you're somebody. Oh, that's me, big time. I'm going to show you, you know, that I make a difference, right? My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Been there. Shaking so bad that I can't think, can't write. I remember being at the liquor store trying to write out a check, you know. Right. Kind of hard to do. I just didn't go to my finals, you know. Started out making straight A's in college, and by the time that semester rolled around, I'm not even showing up to the finals because I have no idea what's going on. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. So in the midst of all this, Bill finds the love of his life. They get married, and it's starting to freak her out because she don't drink like him. She sees something going on, right? We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Honey, I work better. I think better. I got all these ideas. This is the way it happened. It's better for me. Drinking is working. He's trying to still her out, you know, let her know that he's on board. He's on the roll. He's doing everything that he can. And just back off, man. I'm right. Look at all these great minds back in the day. Look, they were drunk. By the time I completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. Anybody one of those people start one thing and you get done with it and like, man, that ain't it. Well, I think I'm going to be a plumber, you know, or I'm going to work construction, right? Like building stuff with my hand. Get to be weather like this and nope, I need an office job, you know. Right? Nothing seems to satisfy Bill, right? He the drive for success was on. He has a plan and he gets the plan started. No, that ain't it. I need to switch. You know, the inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. If you read the history on Bill, there's a reason that he has that metaphor in there. You know, when he was a little boy, he was reading a National Geographic or whatever, and they were talking about the Aborigines in Australia, and they had developed this weapon called the boomerang, and they're the only people on the planet that could make a boomerang. And Bill, as a young boy, set out to prove that magazine wrong. You know, Bill had some willpower. He had willpower. And he set out to Whitland and everything, trying to make boomerangs, going through all the wood at the farm, you know, and I think the last straw is he took a piece of the headboard out of his grandparents' bed and made this boomerang and kind of pissed everybody off. But he took his grandpa out there into the snow and everything and said, "Watch this." And I think he was 11 years old at the time or 13, and he threw that boomerang and it damn near cut their heads off on the return flight. He made it. So he's using that same metaphor for alcohol. He had no idea that what worked for him in the beginning was one day going to end up almost killing him. Had no idea. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000 and went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. So Bill becomes kind of like a stock analyst, you know. So he had this idea that, you know, if you just found out people are investing in all these companies, they don't know anything about it. But if we get a book on these companies and find out all the details of this company, all the little inner workings of this company, then we can make wise decisions and we'll know when companies are undervalued and we can buy their stock. And he tried to persuade these people. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And he just said, "Screw it. I'm going to do it anyway." Anybody ever been there? They tell you not to go off to college or this college or take that job. Nope, I'm doing it. I got to do what I got to do. And that was Bill. It says, "We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, and a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed." Yeah, they had that. Was it what's the name of that book? The Motorcycle Diaries or something? You know, and you see the picture, and I think Bill was in the sidecar. Lois was driving the motorcycle. You know? Friends thought they were nuts. Says, "I had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year." You know, during this time, one of the times they were by the General Electric factory. And Bill was at a bar, of course. You know, Lois is out camping in a tent, and he's at the bar researching. And I did a lot of research in bars, too. But he struck up a conversation with some guys who worked in the lab. And after a few drinks, they invited him back into the lab, and they showed him all the little gizmos that they were working on at the time, and that was part of his report back to his investors, that saying, "Look, these guys are onto some great stuff here. We need to invest in this company." This is the kind of stuff Bill was doing. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several $1,000s for that year. You know, multiply that by 10 or 20%. They were doing pretty darn good back in the day. "For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived." You know, you get a little money and an alcoholic and people pat me on the back, and you betcha I had arrived, man. I like that. My little ego likes those pats on the back and everybody thinking that I'm all cool and, oh, this is good stuff. "My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part of my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends." Those are the cats that leave when you run out of money, you know. Those are the fair-weathered friends, you know. My drinking assumed the more serious proportions. So this drinking that works in the beginning, now it's starting to take a more important role in his life, and now he's saying it assumes more serious proportions. Sounds like he's progressing, right? The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. So now Bill, all these little friends that Bill has accumulated, now his drinking is running them off. And they're saying, Bill, you need to chill out, man. Don't drink so much. Does Bill heed their advice? No. Bill says, see ya. Move on down the road. I ran off a lot of good people back in the day because of my drinking. My drinking scared them, right? They tried to get me to stop or moderate. No, I'll lose the friends. I'm not losing the bottle. Seems that's what Bill's doing. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There'd been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. But we'll just have to take him at his word for that, right? As Bill sees it, as Lois remembers it. You know, there's two sides to that coin, you know. But we'll take him at his word for that, right? We're not going to rewrite the book. It says, in 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud while I started to overtake Walter Hagen. You know, so Bill, that ego is still there for Bill, right? I mean, that's like Walter Hagen back then is like Tiger Woods today. That's like me telling my girlfriend, I'm into this golf thing, let's go out to the country club and I'm going to overtake Tiger. That's Bill's ego. He's going to overtake Walter Hagen. Ego, full force, man. It says, but liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Oh, remember those days? You know, those little flyaway hands. You know, oh, sorry. You know? Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carry him around the exclusive course which had inspired such on me as a lad. I'd inquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. He's high rolling. The booze is working. He's a little shaky in the morning, but booze will fix that. Throwing money here and there, making money hand over fist. It's all good. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from the hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, five hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were my friends. The papers reported men jumping to their death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. Where do we go when the going gets tough? I went back to the bar. See, early on, I had that same type of drive and desire, you know? A little bump in the road, a little wrecked car, a little lost relationship, a little lost job, whatever it may be. I kind of feel down. But by God, I get to the bar and I have a couple of drinks and the plans start to come together again. I was a good planner. I was a great planner when I was drinking. Problem was, I didn't remember any of it the next day. I came up with some good stuff back in the day, you know. That's Bill. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow is another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. The geographical, right? Anybody do the geographical? He moved from Minnesota to Texas to get away from drinking. Drinking's very, very fast. I moved from Dallas, Texas to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Alcoholism is fast. By the time I got there, I was drunk. So by the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No Saint Helena for me, so Bill falls right back into it, starts making money. Things are going great. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. Glad to look back at my story. Did my drinking cause me to lose great opportunities? You bet. Some great opportunities. And I drank them all away. Same with Bill. We went to live with my wife's parents. Now it's getting ugly. Not only did he lost the job, now he's got to go live with the in-laws, you know. It ain't working out too well for Bill. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. They're just not doing it Bill's way, you know. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. Now, a lot of us say that's the perfect scenario. I stay home and drink, she works, right? But let's think about it to the time frame. In the late 20s and 30s, the man was the man of the house. The man got up at the crack of dawn and went out and busted his rear and brought home the bacon, right? That is his job, right? Now, of course, we're more enlightened today and women have jobs, but back in the day, the man was supposed to bring home the money and the wife was supposed to take care of the household. That's just the way it was. And if you're a man and you ain't working and your wife is working, that's not a good thing. And so imagine Bill's ego. Imagine Bill thinking of how he feels about himself. And now drinking has taken such proportions that he's lost the job. They've run through all their money. And now his sainted wife has got to go work. You know that's got to play a number in his head. You know that's got to get him down. It says, I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. So now Bill's going to Merrill Lynch and the like, coming up with great ideas, drunk, trying to get these guys on board. They don't want him around. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. So he's crossed the line. God, back in the beginning, it worked so well. Somewhere along the line, early on for me, but somewhere along the line, I crossed that line. And it was no longer just happy, fun times, celebrations and stuff to drink. I had to drink. It was a necessity. If I went to the grocery store, I had a drink. If I went to a movie, if you had a party, I was well oiled before I got to your party. It became a necessity. I had to drink. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I'd pay my bills at the bars and the delicatessens. Wait a second. Bill's got to be a little humiliated that his wife is out working and he's not. Right? She's taking care of the household. Not a good thing. So he manages to put a little deal together, and you're telling me that he doesn't help out with the household, he pays off his bar tab. A little selfish? A little dishonest? Wow. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by a half dozen bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Hell, that was breakfast. Half a bottle of vodka, you know, good to go. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. And there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hopes. Remember that, doing that to our loved ones? Oh, honey, I'm never going to do it again. You buy her flowers, you mow the lawn, you go on for a while. Everybody, all my family would gather around me again, and everybody's kind of loving on me, and I'm doing such a good job. That's what Bill's doing. Gradually, things got worse. Oh, man. We just thought it was bad. They get worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point in 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Right? And Bill formed this group, and they were going to make him, I think he was going to run the company, right? But they knew Bill's past. You know, they knew his drinking past, and they wrote into the contract that, hey, yeah, you're going to do this, you're going to share generously in the profits, but if you drink, you're done. He's got all the hope in the world. He's got this great business opportunity. Every reason in the world not to drink. He's out playing cards with some fellas, and they pass around a bottle of Jersey White Lightning. passes Bill. No, I'm not drinking today. This is great. I love playing cards. Mm-hmm. And on the second or third go-round, you know, Bill starts to think, you know, I ain't never had me any Jersey White Lightning. And the bottle came to him again, and he got drunk, and there goes the job. Huh. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not so much as take one drink. I was through forever. Anybody say that? I'm done, and I mean it this time. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. By God, he ain't gonna drink. Just put the plug in the jug. Just say no. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. Not working out too well for him. There'd been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone pushed a drink my way and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. That's a good way to say insanity. Appalling lack of perspective, right? Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. Remember those days? Beating on your chest, walk through the grocery store and you end up on the beer aisle by mistake. And you walk by and you don't drink. And I'm telling, I was down the beer aisle and didn't drink. I got what it takes, running 5 miles a day, feeling all tough. That's Bill, man. He thinks he's got it. He's got it whooped. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. Now wait a second. He was just sure that he was away from the drinking thing. And he walks into a bar to telephone. How'd you like to have telephones on your trigger list? We're screwed if that's the case, right? He goes in to telephone, and next thing you know, he's drunk. Now, I was going to pick up a 60-day chip in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Not a cloud on the horizon. Still had a little money in the bank. Nobody's chasing me. My sponsor's going to take me out to dinner with a bunch of the people at that meeting. 60 days sober. Damn near died 60 days prior to that. Not a cloud on the horizon. Walk into that meeting. I hear, Mita, JK. It's two girls I know sitting on a little outside table. Start to talk to them. Next thing you know, it's like 3 or 4 days later. I have no idea what happened. In no time, I was beating on the bar asking myself how it had happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I'd manage better next time, but I might as well good and drunk then, and so I did. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next day are unforgettable. The courage to do battle is not there. Remember those days? You know, back page before, he has that fierce determination to win. Now I've drank so much that the next day it is so regrettable and so remorseful and so pitiful that I can't even do battle with it anymore. Can't do it. My brain raced uncontrollably and there was the terrible sense of impending calamity. You know, what happened? Peeking out the door or the windows, you know, to see if there's anything hanging off the hood of my car, you know, like a body or something, you know. Or where is my car? How did I get here, you know? I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it's scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. So he's got to drink through it. Got to drink. Morning paper told me that the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? Now, there's an option. There's one way to stop drinking. Foolproof. If you can pull it off. Never when I was 15 did I think drinking would get me to that point, but at the end of my drinking, that's exactly, I was wanting to die. I was just a coward. I couldn't do it. No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. He's just drinking all over again. drinking for oblivion. Wake up, can't stand it, gotta drink. Wow. I like the hopeless state of mind and body. In order for me to get through the day, I gotta drink, but it's killing me. Or I'll put it another way. In order to live, I had to drink, but it was killing me. Huh. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. So now Bill's turned into a coward in his own household and he's stealing from his wife. I stole from my family. I stole from my girlfriends, my friends. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were many flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Trying that geographical again. Well, let's go to Vermont. Can't drink in Vermont, you know. Let's go here. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag a mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. You can just imagine Bill on Clinton Street dragging a mattress down so he don't jump out the window, shaking and vibrating. Not a pretty picture. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. Y'all do that? I was telling some guys outside, you know, when I got here in 99, here I am at the Parkland Hospital, you know, where they took John F. Kennedy. You know, I'm at Parkland Hospital working these ER doctors for Libriums and stuff, and I've got a big Avion bottle that I had filled with vodka, so I'm hooked up to IVs so I don't die. Working these guys for Libriums, and I'm drinking vodka in the emergency room. That'll land you on the rocks, man. Needless to say, that hospital is done with me. They don't want to see me anymore. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking. I was 40 pounds underweight. He's dying of malnutrition. He ain't eating. I couldn't eat. I could barely hold down the booze. Food was a no-go. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics, Towns Hospital. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hopes, right? I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Well, think about that. A lot of us have been to the treatment center, and you get all that knowledge, right? And surely when you get out, you're never going to return to where you got, you know, because I know what's killing me now, alcoholism. But that's a ludicrous thing. If you went to the hospital, they diagnosed you with brain cancer, and you found out all there was about brain cancer, does that fix anything? No, it gets you zero. But here I am faring forth out of a treatment center with high hopes that now that I understand myself a little bit better, I understand what's killing me, I understand my little inner child a little bit better, king baby and all that stuff, now I'm not going to drink. Crazy talk. But it wasn't, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. So here he's at the end stages of alcoholism, and he gets a period of sobriety, and he starts to drink it again, and he, in a short amount of time, ends up way worse off than where he began. Progressive in nature. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. And the legend has it that he's sitting outside the room and he hears Silkworth telling his wife, he ain't going to make it. He's going to die during DTs, or we're going to have to lock him up. He's done. It's church, you know. Imagine hearing that. Soon she would have to give me over to the undertaker of the asylum. They didn't need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. He just wants to get done. He can't take it. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. And I gotta think back to, you know, put myself in his shoes. And I think back to my sainted mother. I mean, you know, we grew up together. She had me when she was young, you know. And the hell that I put her through. And I wanted desperately to make things right with her. And I couldn't do it. Because I had to drink. I think Bill really, in his heart of hearts, he didn't want to hurt Lois. He didn't. But he had to drink. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. There's a pretty darn good definition of step one. God. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. Fear sobered me a bit. Second guy I ever sponsored. Just got out of prison. Went to this little treatment center. We got a judge down there, Judge Baraka. He don't play games. Judge Baraka told him, this guy had been before his court a bunch of times, and Judge Baraka told him, said, I don't know why they let you out, but they did. Your case comes across my court one more time for anything, 10 flat. Fear sobered my guy a bit. Just got out of doing a 7-year stretch. He don't want to go back down south. Fear sobered him a bit until he got out of that treatment center. He's now finishing out 10 flat. Judge Baraka don't play around. Fear will sober you a bit. Had all kinds of fears. Fear I'm going to lose that relationship, lose that job, lose that car, lose my family. It sobered me a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. In Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I'd have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In the reality, it was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. It's pretty amazing stuff. He went from that bitter morass of self-pity, the bottle owning him, to the fourth dimension of existence. So let's see how he got there.
All right. Wow. You know, later on in the book, it tells us our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like. And in a general way, I think we all know exactly what Bill Wilston used to be like. And now we're going to go into the transition of what happened. And then later we're going to find out what his life is like now that he's done this. So if you ever wonder what a speaker meeting is for, this is it right here. In a general way, what we were like. Now we're going to lay out what happened. And it says, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. What a lovely thought. You ever been there? At the point where you're just drinking to oblivion, and you know for that moment, you don't have to go anywhere for a couple days. I got enough booze to keep me through. I'm right where I need to be. You know, drinking yourself to death is a slow process. And he was well stocked. He said, my wife was at work. I wondered whether I'd dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. And it's funny, we're hiders, aren't we? I mean, I hid bottles and I lived alone. Think about that. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Hiding a perfectly legal substance just doesn't make sense. It says, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. And it's interesting because knowing the history, this is Ebbie Thatcher. And this is Bill's closest, dearest friend. He's known for a long, long time. And the history of that is they were drinking buddies. They'd love to drink. But the one thing Bill always looked at Ebbie in, he always looked at Ebbie in a different light than he looked at himself. He always looked at Ebbie as, you know, Ebbie's really got a drinking problem. And, you know, if I ever got as bad as Ebbie, I think I'd stop drinking because that boy's got a problem. Now that we know this information, look where this story goes. It was years since I could remember him coming to New York he was sober. I'm surprised he doesn't have an exclamation point there. He says, it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. See, back in the day, there wasn't much they did with drunks. I mean, they gave you as many chances as they could. They'd try to help you out, but basically, once the court systems and society was done with you, you were committed. It was a life sentence. You went to the state hospital for alcoholic insanity. It was goodbye time. And he had heard Ebbie had gotten some trouble. He was out drinking one night and ended up, I believe it was early in the morning, he ended up driving through a woman's house, ended up in her kitchen, his car, with him in it. By that time, the court systems were done with Ebbie, and Bill had heard he must be heading upriver. He's going to get locked up, and he's not going to be hearing from Ebbie anymore. Now that we know this, look at this. It says, I wonder how he escaped. There's no way in Bill's mind that he would have ever got out of this, so he's thinking, the old boy must have broke loose and ran. You know, he says, I wonder how he escaped. Of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought of only recapturing the spirit of other days. Who's Bill thinking about?
Himself.
He knows Ebbie is in deep trouble, about to be committed for a life sentence and be locked up in a state institution. And what is he thinking about? I can get my drink on. And I can somehow try to grab that effect that's so elusive that we chase after, unmindful of anybody around us, aren't we? It's horrible. Oh, I thought of only recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we chartered an airplane to complete a jag, which is an interesting story if you ever heard it. They heard an airport was being opened up, I believe, back in their own hometown or close to their hometown. So Bill and Ebbie had an idea that they thought they wanted to be the first airplane to land at that airport. So they ran into a pilot and they made it a party and a day of it. And when they landed, they were the first plane to hit that tarmac. And the door opened to the plane and Ebbie and Bill fell right out of the plane, stumbling drunk. What a christening of an airport, huh? Those two guys showing up, the first plane. He says, his coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing in oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened, he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? It's interesting because the funniest thing is I can relate to is John and I, by the way, we're not relatives. No relation whatsoever. We just share the same last name. But we were like passing ships in different AA groups. We ran across each other throughout the 90s in the Dallas area. And it was the March of the Dead. And I'd be hanging on by the skin of my teeth in AA, and John would be showing up just dead. And I'd be hanging on, next thing I'd disappear. And when I'd come back, he'd be on his way out. And I'll never forget the last time when I walked in 2000, who did I see? There's John. And the one thing that I didn't see, there was something different about him. And here, if you've ever seen it, seen someone, their life being rearranged by this program, it's like there's the light comes back inside their eyes, you know, that you can just see it. I mean, it's so evident to other people. And here, Bill's looking at Ebby and going, there is something radically different about this guy. He says, I pushed a drink across the table. Wonderful. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wonder what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come on, what's this all about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smiling. He said, I've got religion. You could hear, at that point, can you imagine? You could hear the doors clanging shut in Bill's mind. You know, Bill, later on we're going to find out, he's got a little thing going on with the God and the religion thing, and Ebby almost lost him right there. I mean, the steel trap almost closed in Bill's mind. Thank God, he says, I was aghast, so that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, now as suspected, a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. Thank God, you know. But the thing is, Ebby regrouped, and here's where he saved the day. He said, but he did no ranting. You know, Ebby didn't get up on a soapbox. Thank God. No holier-than-thou attitude they talk about. He just said in a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, two members of the Oxford group, came and stood in front of the judge with Ebby, and persuaded the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea. The old Oxford, what was it, the six tenets and four concepts, I believe, is what absolutes that the Oxford group had, their simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked! ! It's a bold statement right there. Let's think about it in modern day. A newcomer walks in, he's 2 months sober, he hears that his friend is dying. And this newcomer says, I want to go talk to my friend, maybe I can help him. And what do we tell him? Oh no, you've got to have at least a year before you could help somebody. Anybody ever heard that in AA before? Where would we be today if this guy with 2 months of sobriety had not got off his dead butt and went and tried to help his friend who was dying? Where would we be today? Think about that for a second. So much for those myths in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous again. It isn't about time, is it? It has nothing to do about time, how long you've been. It says, he had come to pass his experience along to me. All Ebby was doing was, you know what, sharing his experience and his knowledge of the problem and of the solution, passing it on to Bill in hopes of giving Bill a little bit of hope that just maybe it might work for him, but there's a hook. He was going to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Remember, alcohol was his master. Bill had succumbed to step one long before AA ever or the Oxford groups ever showed up. See, we do step one not inside these rooms. The step one experience happens out there. The day where you wake up and you realize there is no way you're going to get through this day without taking a drink. You've done everything you could do to try to control it, and you've finally bridged over to, all right, then I'll never do it again. And then you find out in your heart of hearts that you are unable to do that, no matter what you come up with. He was hopeless, without a chance of success. What a lovely word. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me hard to swallow. He bristled with antagonism, did he not? There it is. Some of you may understand. Walking through these doors, we've been through a lot. You start talking about that religious thing, that God thing, and some of us get a little dicey on that subject. The wartime day in Old Winchester Cathedral came back. I'd always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means a blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushed nowhere. What a wonderful thought, isn't that? My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that's as far as I had gone. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. Anybody ever done that a la carte religious thing before? Yeah, I'll take that and a little bit of that, but you know what? The rest of that you can have. I mean, I totally relate to Bill's ideas on this. There were some parts of it I could accept, and there were some parts of it I just really didn't want to accept. And I could see some reasoning too and some not. There was just a lot of clamors running around inside my head. You know, you look at Bill's experience, the wars which had been fought, the burnings and the chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether on balance the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. Look back at Bill's experience. He had fought in a world war, saw a lot of horrific things. He sat through the stock exchange collapse, and people are jumping out of towers of high finance because they had lost everything. Bill's looking at people trying to suggest God being something personal to him, and he just couldn't see it. Of all the things that he had been through, he just didn't see it. But that's okay. See, we don't have to see it. But here's where it all came together. But my friend sat before me and made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. Remember, he looked at Ebby and went, there's no way Ebby could ever get sober on his own. Yet here's Ebby showing up at his doorstep, and there's something different about him, and he's not drinking. There's something there. He said his human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he admitted complete defeat. Right back to the alcohol was my master. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known! Exclamation point. Had this a power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There's no way Ebby could have done it on his own. Bill knew that in his heart of hearts. There had been no more power in him than there was at me at that minute, and this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. There's a wonderful lesson to be learned in those two pages. If you look at step two in a nutshell, the fact of the matter is step one is too simple. I'm screwed. I'm going to drink no matter what. I'm condemned to drink. And when I drink, I lose all control, and horrible things happen after I lose control when I'm drinking. It's a death sentence. Step two is so simple. Here's Ebby sitting across the table from Bill. Somehow Ebby is not drinking. He's happy and he's free. There's the hope of step two. Just maybe what worked for Ebby might work for me. The miracle of step two is I do not have to believe in anything. The only requirement that I have to believe in is that I'm screwed in step one. Step two equates to one thing. I hope. I hope this just might work for me. I don't have to believe it. I don't know about you. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in June of 2000, and I was convinced it was not going to work. But I was dying, and I couldn't come up with any other option. I just hope maybe I was wrong. The simplest step two was. Look at Bill. It opened the door. The miracle is he shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I did not like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who have felt the same way. And thank God we have chapter 4, because it's just trying to open the door. Bill's door was opened just a little bit by Ebby, and the sunlight began to come through, and that was the start. It was the start of a wonderful path into the fourth dimension, as described earlier. My friend suggested what seemed a novel idea. He said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" That has saved so many newcomers since this was written. It's amazing. We come all, some of us come in here all twisted up about the God thing. And like my sponsor said, if you've got a problem with God, why don't you come up with a God that you can live with today? And the thought that went through my mind is, oh my God, I'll screw that up too. I've screwed everything else up, you know. But it's as simple as that. All to make a beginning in this, why don't I choose my own conception of God? That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. How about that? It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. See, step two doesn't say we have to believe in anything. Step two is I just have to be willing to believe. The promise is that we're going to come to believe. It may take time, but all I have to be is willing. Just maybe. That's all we're doing, is a just maybe. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. How about that? The hope is there. But, unfortunately, there's a little rough going in between the hope and the freedom. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly within myself. Life looms large, doesn't it? I can get the problem. I can fully understand it, the knowledge of the problem. I can get a little bit of hope in step two. Is that going to keep me sober? No. It is not. Knowing the problem and knowing the solution still is not going to get me sober. I can be diagnosed with cancer and knowing if I go through chemotherapy, I stand a great chance of surviving. Knowing those two things, all I've done is played mental gymnastics. It still won't keep me sober. There's something that I have to do after that, and that's what we're about to get into. Said, and so I had been ever since, how blind I had been. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. And I believe this was December 11th, 1934. Mm-hmm. Bill showed up in Towns Hospital for the last time, course of his third treatment. Here we go. He started developing the DTs, and what did the doctor say to his wife? You're probably going to die of it, or you're going to become a wet brain. Bill's scared to death. He shows back up and sees old Silkworth again. And here he is. It says, there I humbly offer myself to God as I had then understood him, to do with me as he would. I place myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing and that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. I believe this was December. Let me get these bear with me on the dates. I believe this was December 14th. About 3 days after Bill stopped shaking violently, he asked that Ebby come back and see him, and he looked at Ebby and said, "All right, what is it that you are doing? Please show me." And here's where Bill took what we know is step three. How about that? 3 days sober. He's ready to get rolling. Well, let's find out what happened. The 14th and 15th, I believe, is when this all transpired. My schoolmate visited me. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I had felt resentment. What does that sound like? Sounds awful familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like he's doing a four-step with old Ebby, isn't he? What we now know of as a four-step. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Boy, that sounds a lot like step 8 and 9, doesn't it? Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. How about that? This guy's 3 days, 4 days sober, and he's working through the steps rapidly while he's still in the hospital. What a unique concept, huh? I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. I'll be darned, he's learning a little bit of step 11 while he's there. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore to my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. So from what we know, by about December 15th or 16th of 1934, Bill had worked what we now know through steps 11. Had not gone out and actually done step 9 yet, but was fully brought up to speed on what he was expected to do once he left that hospital. This is amazing stuff, isn't it? My friend promised me that these things were done, or when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Did you notice something here? What book are we reading? I believe it's titled Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? Last we checked on the title page. Wouldn't you have thought that if they were going to write precisely what they meant, why didn't he write down my alcoholic problem? Something to ponder, isn't it? Because alcohol is not our problem. John showed us. In the doctor's opinion, he laid it out. Alcohol is not our problem. Alcohol is our solution. Our solution sucks, for lack of a better word. It kills us, slowly and painfully. But when I get restless, irritable, and discontent, what do? I drink and I go to ease and comfort. Is alcohol a problem? No, it just solved a problem, did it not? The only problem is we overshoot the solution by about 6, 8 months, 10 years, and we miss the mark by a little bit. See, our problem is now that we're not drinking, life is our problem. And I'll be darned, Ebby showed him a way of answering all his problems. And program of action didn't solve his problems. It got him to what? His Creator. This program got us to the power that would solve all our problems. How about that? The hope of step two happened for him. Belief in a power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order of things were the essential requirements. Translation, it sounds like a must, doesn't it? Essential requirements. Breathing is an essential requirement to life. Do we agree? Sounds like a must, doesn't it? In order for me to live, I must breathe. How about that? We found another must. Oh no. Controversial part of the program again. Simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. Have you ever heard someone introduce? I've enjoyed the gift of sobriety since 1954. Have you ever, you hear people saying that? Like it's a fact. But I have to look at that. Next time you catch yourself saying you're enjoying the gift of sobriety, was it a gift? You mean someone walked up and handed it to you and you didn't have to do anything? I'll be darned. Sobriety is not a gift. Even Bill told you right here. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. I had to pay the price by doing the work, correct? In order to go from a helpless, hopeless alcoholic to a recovered alcoholic. I had to do the work. A price had to be paid. If I did not do the work, what price would be paid? I would drink again. Either way, that price is going to be paid, isn't it? So it's not truly a gift if you look at it. In essence, in its truest form, it is not a gift. You are going to pay the price one way or another. It says, it meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals. At some of these we balked, didn't we? Gets kind of drastic, doesn't it? But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was an utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though a great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, a spiritual awakening. But his impact on me was sudden and profound, a spiritual experience. Now we know the difference. Some of us have that burning bush. Some of us do not. Some come over time. Some happen profound. Bill's was that burning bush while he was in the hospital. For a moment, I was alarmed. Think about it. This guy who had had problems with God and religion, all of a sudden, he's having that burning bush moment, and he's sitting back going, oh, my God, what is happening to me? I was alarmed. I called my friend the doctor to ask him if I was still sane. Could you imagine what was going through this poor man's head? He's about 5 days, 4 days sober, and it happened. He listened and wondered as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you I do not understand. See, Silkworth only understood the problem. He didn't understand what the solution was, but he knew all about the problem, and he's looking at someone who had found the solution and had that radical change, and he's looking and going, I don't understand what happened. He says, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. Amen. Think about it. The good doctor now sees many men who have had such experiences. He knows they are real. Look at this next line. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been given, so what had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. What were you thinking about your fourth day of sober? How am I going to get that job back, the girl back, and a place to live? And were you thinking about someone else? Remember Bill, who he was. The guy who made a little money and paid his bar tab off as his wife worked, and then he stole money out of her purse when he didn't have any money. And all of a sudden, he's sitting in a hospital not thinking about how am I going to get back on my feet again, but there's people who are just like me dying, and I can help them just like my friend helped me. What a complete change. A total rearrangement of thoughts and ideas. It's an amazing thing. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Absolute necessity. What does that spell out? I'll be darned. They're everywhere, aren't they? They dress them up. They're everywhere in all my affairs. Not only while I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, not only when I'm working with another alcoholic out on the streets, but in all my affairs. You know, the fun places like home, like in traffic. Some of you might understand that. I'm a great driver education person through my windshield, you know. In all my affairs. Someone can attest to that. Here we go again. Particularly was it imperative. There's another $10 must, isn't it? Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Imperative. I must. Vital to permanent recovery. We've got to keep track of what they've told us in the past. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic, exclamation mark. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through what? Work and self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And let's face it, they did not lie to us. Anybody have some rough going in sobriety yet? If you haven't, hang on. It's coming. Oh, is it coming? Life is not going to be a garden path now that you're sober. Guess what? The rest of the world has not changed a bit. It's still exactly the way God wants it to be, and more than likely, you aren't going to agree with it at times. There's going to be certain trials and low spots ahead. This thing is simple to do when everything's going your way. God is great, isn't he? The minute you're about to lose your job or not knowing how you're going to pay your bills, where's God and where's this program? In the next county, isn't it? I got to do something. I got to get busy. But here's where it says, through work and self-sacrifice to other. I call my sponsor, my world is falling apart, and he's like, all right, you got a big book, you got a dollar, go down to the 24-hour club where you sobered up and go talk to another alcoholic. And I'm like, he must be deaf. He did not hear me. Fact of the matter is, he heard me, and he brought me right here and said, get off your butt through work and self-sacrifice with others, and you will survive these certain trials and low spots ahead. It's a promise. Take to the bank. If he did not work, he surely would drink again, and if he drank, he surely would die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Look at this next line. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of getting me a job and a place to stay. Your book doesn't say that. I just assume that's what he'd have to do. The man hasn't held a job in how long? His wife's working at a department store. They have no place to live of their own. But what do? My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. How about that? I was fortunate. Look at the word he uses. I was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. For a year and a half, the man could not find a job. And you know how he described it? Looking back, I was fortunate. Greatest thing that ever happened to me. Why? You know, have you ever noticed God has a way of removing those things blocking you off for him? He does offer assistance. That job's getting in the way. Here, we'll get this job right out of the way. You ever had that happen? Wait a minute, but the job, God knows what he's doing. And here he built, found little work. I was not too well at the time, you think? You can't find a job? He says, I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. Uh-oh. So what did he do? How about that? Look at this. But I soon found when all other measures failed, and boy, do we try all those other measures. We come up with some doozies. It's fun, isn't it? You sit back and listen to these newcomers come up with ideas you hadn't even thought of yet. It's like, where did you come up with that? When all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many, many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It was a design for living that works in rough going. Now we've got something, don't we? How about that? We've got something that not only works on good days, it works on bad days, and it works on horrible days. We've got something that we can hang on to. Now we're going to find out what his life was like now that he did this work. We found out what happened. He got busy, did the work. What did his life end up like? And this is the part we never hear from the podium. We hear all about the tragedies, the war stories. You hear 2 seconds about the steps, and then they close the door and have a nice night. Hopefully the guy's funny and it was a good hour, right? But we never hear about, you know, how great our life is today now that we've done this work. The best part of the deal. Let's find out what happened with Bill. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown among us, of which is a wonderful thing to feel a part of. Feel a part. Isn't it amazing? For a year, it took me a while to get used to people calling me and asking me, how are you doing? And I'm like, what do they want? It's coming. I know they want something. And all they wanted to know was, are you okay? I had no clue what a friend was until this thing. It's an amazing thing. The joy of living we really have, and we do. My God, this isn't a veil of tears. Thank God. I mean, if we didn't enjoy this thing, where would you? If I was not enjoying life, I'm doing some drinking. Think about it. If I'm going to be miserable sober, I might as well be miserable drunk. says, even under pressure and difficulty, I've seen hundreds of families set on their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. I've seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds of bitterness of all sorts wiped out. To see someone that you have walk in front of you and they have that march of the dead in front, no lights in their eyes, and they grab a hold of this thing and their life turns around, and all of a sudden you see them grab a hold of this thing and in the power of God, and you just sit back and go, I hope I played a small part in this because this is the coolest thing I've ever witnessed in my life. We never see it as we're going through it, but man, do we see it in the people we're working with. It is the most amazing thing. I've seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There's scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. That's a promise. You can take it to the bank. That isn't just a high hope. That is a promise of this thing. In one Western city and its environs, there are 1,000 of us in our families. We meet frequently. Underline this, please. Do you know why they had meetings? We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. You notice they didn't say we meet frequently so you at 15 years sober can walk in and complain about how your dog won't stop peeing on the rug, how that divorce is still eating your lunch. That is not what this thing is about. Why did they meet? The original AA group in Akron still has one meeting a week, and that is it, and it is a newcomers meeting to give hope to someone who is dying, just like you were when you came in. If you want to talk about your problems, who should you call? What a novel idea. Your sponsor and do a 10th step. They've got that covered in this book. It's an amazing thing. How about that? All right, I'm off that soapbox. At these informal gatherings, one may often have... I'm sorry, I took the jacket off. Did you notice? It's good. Oh, the gloves are off. All right. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. If you want to see it, come visit me. I'll show you a picture. It's not pretty. We should all have one. They should take pictures of newcomers the day they walk in, and so you can have it, not to be used. Then you hand it to them and say, hang on to this. You can remind yourself just how bad it is. Because we are an unlovely creature in our cups, aren't we? It says, our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic, and boy, are they ever. One poor chap committed suicide in our home. This thing is deadly serious. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it. I suppose some would be shocked by it, our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us or we perish. Most of us feel we need not look further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend, simple talk in our kitchen, and I love you got a picture of it right over there. The table, if anybody noticed, it's sitting right over there with the two cups on it. Multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. Where would we be without that kitchen talk? They'd be having some other conference here today, wouldn't they? It says, Bill W., co-founder of AA, died January 24th, 1971. All right, let's take a break.
You want to use this for the lunch break and then come back after? All right.
I have it.